Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. This episode includes details of graphic violence against children, so please proceed with caution. There are some crimes that are deemed beyond the pale, a phrase that immediately evokes a sense of dread. The murder of small children horrifies society. We are outraged. We cannot fathom the coldness and cruelty it takes to harm a child. This murderer has to be a monster. And that feeling doesn't change when the monster is a teenager. Victims' families and communities are often shocked by young killers, but that shock quickly turns to blind outrage. Even people who are against the death penalty have their core values shaken. We want blood. An eye for an eye is the only justice for some in these cases. Today's case is an example of this type of horror, the senseless brutality of young children at the hands of teenagers. Teens that before their crimes, we would still think of as kids. Their horrific actions immediately turn them into adults overnight. And there is no turning back the clock. Welcome to episode 114, Teenage Annihilation, The Duke Murders. The city of Pelham, Alabama is about 38 square miles, and it's located within Shelby County, just 15 miles south of Birmingham. The original boundaries of Shelby County surrounded lands that belonged to the Creek Native Americans until the 1814 Treaty of Fort Jackson. The treaty ended the Creek War of 1813 to 1814, and is significant because it forced the Creeks to cede some 21 million acres of land in the Mississippi Territory, much of which is present-day central and south Alabama and southern Georgia. It also led to the removal of the Creek Nation, forcing their people west. The first white settlement in the area, now known as Pelham, was originally named Shelbyville in 1820. At the end of the Civil War, Shelbyville was renamed Pelham for Confederate officer Major John Pelham. The area of Pelham is located within the foothills of Oak Mountain and includes many suburban neighborhoods and upscale homes. It's often referred to as a bedroom community because it's so close to Birmingham, where many Pelham residents commute to work throughout the week. But Pelham is more known for its laid-back atmosphere and fun tourist attractions as I-65 and Highway 31 run through the area. It's perhaps best known for Oak Mountain State Park, where nature lovers can camp, hike, ride on biking trails, and enjoy all kinds of water sports in the lake. The park is also home to the Alabama Wildlife Center, the oldest wildlife rehabilitation facility in the state, caring for over 2,000 wild birds of all species. Blue Water Park is also located there. Originally a quarry, it is now a premier inland dive site for divers of all skills, including beginners. Oak Mountain Amphitheater is an open-air music venue known for big-name country and rock bands who have played there, like Jason Aldean, Florida Georgia Line, the Dave Matthews Band, and John Mayer. The infamous ever-touring jam band Phish, with its own traveling community of fans, is scheduled to perform there this July. The city of Pelham is estimated to have around 25,000 residents and has a relatively low crime rate. It's one of those cities you might think of as more of a small town, a good place to raise a family. Not the kind of town you think of hitting the news every night with a violent crime. But in 1997, that changed with the shocking news of a family of four being brutally murdered in their home. On March 23, 1997, around 9 p.m., 16-year-old Mark Anthony Duke called 911 from his home in one of Pelham's quiet neighborhoods. He told the operator that his father was dead in their home and that, quote, they had killed him. Pelham police officers rushed to the home of 39-year-old Randy Gerald Duke, the father of the 911 caller, located on Chandawood Drive. When they stepped inside the home, officers found a horrific scene. Along with Randy Duke, they also found the bodies of his fiancée, 29-year-old Deidre Mims Hunt, and her two little girls, 6-year-old Shalisa Nicole Hunt and 7-year-old Chelsea Marie Hunt. The murders were brutal and grisly. Randy Duke and Deidre Hunt had both been shot, and the two little girls' throats had been cut. As a Pelham officer made his way through the scene, he spotted 32 and 45 caliber shells on the ground. The police questioned Mark Duke, the son of victim Randy Duke, about how he had come across the scene. Mark told the authorities that after coming home that evening, he got as far as the foyer before he spotted the body of his father and knew something was wrong. He said he stopped in his tracks and called 911. When asked if he wanted to be placed in protective custody, Mark answered yes, and he was taken with the officers back to the station. More investigators arrived on the scene and began collecting evidence as the news spread like wildfire through Pelham about what had happened in the Duke home. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Randy Gerald Duke was born in Chicago in January 1958, but was raised in Alabama, where both of his parents were from. At 39, he was 10 years older than his new fiance. Deidre Lynn Mims Hunt was born in Alabama in July of 1967, 29 years old at the time of her death. Before becoming engaged to Randy Duke, she had been married to a man named Thomas Hunt Jr. and had two daughters. Chelsea Marie Hunt, born April 9, 1989, and her sister, Shalisa Nicole Hunt, born December 12, 1990. Born just barely 9 months apart, the girls were practically twins, though their personalities couldn't be more different. Chelsea was a tomboy, and Shalisa was a girly girl. Deidre and Thomas Hunt divorced, but Thomas's sister, Tara Hunt Simmons, told Alabama Birmingham Real-Time News that the divorce did not change the friendship between the two or their desire to be the best parents they could to Chelsea and Shalisa. After the divorce, the parents worked out custody so that the girls would not have to switch schools. They lived with their father during the week in Thorsby, where their elementary school was, and then spent the weekends with their mother in Pelham. Miss Simmons told the reporter, quote, Deidre was a wonderful mother, and she knew the girls living with their dad and remaining in the same school was what was best for them. So she sacrificed and did what was best for them. Deidre was family. A piece of paper couldn't change that. Their aunt describes the two little girls as opposites. Chelsea was the tough tomboy, always looking out for her slightly younger sister, Shalisa, who Miss Simmons described as prim and proper. Randy Duke and Deidre Hunt had been together for a little over a year when he proposed, shortly before that tragic spring night. Randy worked as a plumber and had a son from a previous relationship. 16-year-old Mark Anthony Duke had lived with his father while attending high school. But according to Tara Eccles, Mark's mother, her son and Randy Duke didn't have much of a relationship until Mark was about 10 years old. She told the Montgomery Advisor that her son often went by the name of Anthony Eccles before he reconnected with his father. The small city of Pelham was rocked by the murders in the Duke home, and as information about the scene spread, neighbors stood outside and watched as the victims were carried out of the house. Tara Hunt Simmons, like the rest of the Hunt family, could not bring herself to imagine what had happened inside that house and was in disbelief. Just 2 days earlier, on that Friday, March 21st, she had been with Deidre and the girls as Shalisa prepared to participate in her first beauty pageant. When speaking to reporters, she recalled the happiness of the two little girls before their lives were cut short. Shalisa competed in the pageant with her blonde hair curled in adorable ringlets, while Chelsea stayed with her dad and played a game of Trouble. The morning after the murders were discovered, the Pelham Police Department held a press conference to update the community on the tragedy. News of the murders had already begun circulating around the Birmingham suburb and surrounding area, and counselors were brought in to comfort Shalisa and Chelsea's classmates at the elementary school. The Anniston Star reported that the police chief addressed the media and stated that investigators were looking into the possibility of a quadruple murder or triple murder-suicide in the case, based on the scene. But he also mentioned during the press conference that there did not appear to be any forced entry into the Duke home. The governor's office offered a $20,000 reward for information leading to an arrest and conviction in the case, to encourage anyone with details on what happened to step forward. Autopsies confirmed that Randy and Deidre both died from gunshot wounds, and that both little girls died from blunt cuts to their throats. They drowned in their own blood as it filled up their airways. Chelsea even suffered defensive wounds to her hands. During the autopsies, several bullets were found, and a ballistics expert confirmed that the bullets were consistent with the shells found at the scene. Investigators and law enforcement continued to spend many hours processing the scene in the days following the 911 call. After taking Mark Duke into protective custody, police questioned him on his whereabouts and actions in the days leading up to the murder. Pretty quickly, investigators became suspicious of the teenager and his alibi for the time of the murders. They had received reports from several community members that had heard Mark Duke threaten to kill his father, and that the pair were known to have a rocky relationship. A female acquaintance of Mark's even said he had confessed to her. According to court transcripts, Mark said he had spent the day before he discovered his father's body with a couple of friends and had gone to see a movie, for which he provided officers with the ticket stub to prove it. Based on this line of questioning, investigators met with the friends that Mark had claimed to be with. 19-year-old Brandon Samra, 17-year-old Michael Ellison, and 17-year-old David Collins. Law enforcement had heard of the group of boys in references to a loose-knit but rough crowd who often ran together. As they questioned the oldest of the group, Brandon Samra, investigators realized they probably had their suspects. Not long into their conversation with Samra, he confessed to investigators what had really happened to Randy, Deidre, Chelsea, and Shalisa. As a tape recorder ran in a tight interrogation room at the Pelham Police Department, 19-year-old Michael Brandon Samra described an appalling plot that had been crafted by his friend, 16-year-old Mark Anthony Duke. According to Brandon, on Saturday, March 22nd, Mark Duke was hanging out with Mike Ellison, David Collins, and Brandon, just as he did many other weekends. Their group headed to Mark's father's home, where Mark asked him if he could borrow his pickup truck. But Randy Duke told his son no. Angry, Mark left with his friends and went to Mike Ellison's house. Mark complained that he was tired of being bossed around and told what to do by his father. He was seething that his dad would not let him borrow the truck. Mark told the three others that he wanted to kill his father, and started a plan that was hatched right there in 17-year-old Mike's bedroom. Mark got a .45 caliber pistol and Mike a .32 caliber. It's unclear from court transcripts or news reports where the guns came from, but the reports seem to imply that they came from the Ellison home. Mark wiped the pistol and each bullet down before replacing them in the magazine and instructed Mike to do the same with his gun. Ready and hyped, the four boys piled in Mike Ellison's car and headed back to Randy Duke's home. During this fateful ride, at the mention of Deidre Hunt and her two little girls, Mark Duke callously told his friends that no witnesses could be left behind and that everyone in the home would have to die. As they arrived at the home, Mike must have had a change of heart because he gave the .32 pistol to Brandon Samra. And then Mike Ellison and David Collins stayed in the car as Mark and Brandon stalked into the Duke home. Randy, Deidre, Chelsea, and Shalisa were in the main part of the home, past the area of the foyer, when Mark and Brandon walked in with guns pointed. They stormed the home, having already determined who was going to kill who. According to Brandon, Mark shot his father first. He then attempted a second shot, but his aim was thrown off as his father threw a figurine at him. Mark aimed again, shooting his father a third time as he said, quote, he would see him in hell, according to Brandon. While Mark ruthlessly gunned down his father, Brandon shot at Deidre. The bullet hit her face, knocking out some of her teeth. Despite being shot in the face, Deidre grabbed her daughters and ran up the stairs, but she was only able to make it a little further before Brandon shot her again. What happened next is like a scene from a horror movie. According to trial transcripts, Deidre managed to get into the upstairs bathroom with one of her girls, 6-year-old Shalisa, who she hid in the shower as she locked the bathroom door. 7-year-old Chelsea ran into an upstairs bedroom and hid under the bed. Brandon Samra kicked the bathroom door but was unable to break it down. After making sure his father was dead, Mark ran up the stairs and knocked a hole in the bathroom door, reaching through to unlock it from the inside. He entered into the bathroom and shot Deidre with a final and fatal blow. Out of bullets, he pulled out a knife he had gotten from the kitchen and cut Shalisa's throat. Mark and Brandon continued their rampage through the home, searching for Chelsea. They went into the bedroom where she was hiding and pulled her out from under the bed. The little girl fought for her life, sustaining 15 knife wounds to her left hand and 3 to her right, before Mark held her down and Brandon cut her throat. Following this horrendous attack, Mark and Brandon washed the blood from their hands in the home and then hid the 2 guns. Mark stole the wallet from his dad's body before they left the house, throwing the knife in a nearby storm drain. Once back in Mike Ellison's car, the 4 headed to the movies so that they could use the ticket stubs as alibis if they were questioned later. The following day, they returned to the Duke home to stage the scene as a robbery gone bad. They rummaged through the house and overturned items, and after the others left, Mark called 911 pretending he had stumbled onto the site of his slain family. Based on Brandon's horrific confession, he and Mark were arrested. On Wednesday, March 26th, they were both indicted on charges of capital murder. That day in court, Mark declined the offer of a court-appointed attorney because he said his family was arranging one for him. Despite this, a temporary court-appointed attorney was assigned to represent Mark for that day because the prosecution was granted a motion to take photographs of scratches seen on his arms. The 2 arrests sent shockwaves through the community as citizens grappled with the idea that Randy's teenage son could have committed such a vicious crime. And law enforcement warned that there would likely be more arrests in the case in the following days. That time came just one day later, when Michael Ellison and David Collins were charged with intentional murder and/or aiding and abetting intentional murder. All 4 teens were held in the Shelby County Jail. Samra and Duke without bond, and Ellison and Collins with a bond of $1 million each. The Anniston Star reported that the chief of police acknowledged that Mark Duke and the others involved in the case were part of a wannabe gang that was composed of around 10 people their age, but it remained unclear if this gang had anything to do with the murders. After the arrests were made, neighbors were relieved. A next-door neighbor of Randy Duke told the Montgomery Advertiser, "I'm just horrified that a human being can do that to another human being." All four teens had similar backgrounds and were having trouble in school before the murders. Samra, Ellison, and Collins had all dropped out of high school, while Mark Duke remained in a community program for troubled teens. David Collins' mother had died, and Brandon Samra had recently been kicked out of his parents' home after refusing to enter a drug rehabilitation program. Mark Anthony Duke, like the others, had a hard time in school and was just beginning to repair things with his dad when their relationship turned sour. As a child, he had lived with his grandmother, only seeing his father sporadically. Mark's mother, Tara Eccles, told the Montgomery Advisor that she split up with Randy Duke when she was just 6 months pregnant. At the age of 10, Mark Duke and his father began getting closer, and he began going back and forth between his parents' homes, changing schools every couple of years to accommodate his moves. Tara Eccles told the Montgomery Advertiser, quote, "I just don't know what happened. This is just a shock to everybody." In the months leading up to the murder, she admitted she had not seen her teenage son since Christmas. "I'm sorry, but it was March, almost 3 months after Christmas, and she hadn't seen her son. I'm not excusing what Mark did, but I do believe his erratic childhood molded him. He first lived with his grandma, then back and forth between his mom and dad, a man he barely knew. And now, into his troubled teen years, his dad had a new fiance with two little girls he showered with affection. I don't think Mark's murderous rage was simply over not being able to borrow his dad's truck." I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. I'm sure many of you are missing your favorite workout routine and your favorite instructors. I'm frustrated with my recovery and looking forward to getting back into a routine, so I totally get it. There are at-home alternatives right now, but it's just not the same as being back in class with your instructor blasting heart-pounding music as you work up a sweat. The SoulCycle at-home bike is the answer you're looking for. It converts your home into a SoulCycle studio. The SoulCycle at-home bike has a 21-inch touchscreen, which houses a revolutionary sound system specifically engineered for this bike and SoulCycle's iconic playlists. You get unlimited access to live and on-demand SoulCycle classes, and you can clip your favorite instructors and instantly jump to the front row of the studio on your schedule. Your monthly membership also gives you unlimited access to the other Equinox Plus apps, where you can stream classes for free from other top-tier brands like Equinox, Rumble, TB12, and Pure Yoga. And the best part is, you can get your SoulCycle at-home bike in just 1 to 3 weeks, and they also have financing options available. I think the SoulCycle bike could be the answer to so many of you who are missing your usual fitness routine. Once I'm given the clearance from my doctor, I'm hitting Pure Yoga on the Equinox Plus app. The classes look amazing and just what I need to get back into a healthy routine. Get your SoulCycle at-home bike today by visiting mysoulcyclebike.com/southernfried and use promo code SOUTHERNFRIED to get a pair of free Home Select cycling shoes with your purchase. That's mysoulcyclebike.com/southernfried and use promo code SOUTHERNFRIED to get a pair of free at-home select cycling shoes with the purchase of your SoulCycle at-home bike. mysoulcyclebike.com/southernfried, promo code SOUTHERNFRIED. Like anyone else, keeping my home and family safe is my top priority. Whether it's from a break-in, a fire, a medical emergency, or flooding, SimpliSafe delivers award-winning 24/7 protection. With SimpliSafe, you get the best professional monitors in the business, along with top-quality equipment. They've got your back day and night, ready to send police, fire, or EMTs straight to your door. My husband and I found that SimpliSafe's arsenal of sensors and cameras protect every inch of our home, and yet the setup was so easy. It took maybe 30 minutes. We found the equipment to be really high quality with excellent camera footage. Once you've got it set up, SimpliSafe's professionals take over, monitoring your home 24/7, ready to send you help the moment there is an alarm. Plus, with SimpliSafe, there is no long-term contract, no hidden fees or installation costs. Right now, my listeners get a free home security camera when you purchase a SimpliSafe system at simplisafe.com/southernfried. You also get a 60-day risk-free trial trial, so there's nothing to lose. Visit simplysafe.com/southernfried for your free camera today. That's simplysafe.com/southernfried. As the last two teens suspected to be involved in the murder plot were arrested, the victims were buried just 5 days after their lives were taken. The funerals for all four victims were held on Thursday, March 27th. Randy Duke's service was first, and then 3 hours later, the funerals for his fiancée, Deidre, and her two little girls were held. Hundreds of family members, friends, and mourners attended the burials. According to Birmingham Real-Time News, Shalisa and Chelsea were buried holding hands, as they so often did in life, and their mother was buried next to them. They were laid to rest in Martin Memorial Cemetery in Clanton, Alabama. Randy was buried in Chestnut Creek Cemetery in Pelham, near his own mother. Mark Ellison and David Collins were offered a choice by the prosecution. They could plead guilty and agree to cooperate with the investigation for a lesser sentence, or they could risk pleading not guilty and face the jury. They both decided to plead guilty. Ellison helped police retrieve the guns used in the attack, and both would later go on to testify against Mark Duke and Brandon Samra. For their cooperation, both 17-year-olds were sentenced to 16 years in prison. Brandon Samra's trial came before Mark Duke's. In mid-March of 1998, he pleaded not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. His trial was held in Shelby County Circuit Court, and he was represented by a court-appointed attorney named Richard Bell. According to trial records, before the trial was set to start, Bell filed a petition for a change of venue due to the intense media coverage on the case. During a hearing on the motion, Bell presented clips from the newspapers and videos used in news reports to make his argument. He also had a media and statistical expert who had polled the community testify, but his motion was denied. And now, despite his taped confession to police, where he described the role that he took in the murders, Brandon Samra had recanted his statement. Bell decided to focus on the mental condition of his client and the potential effect that gang influence might have had on Samra, a gang influence that he thought was perpetrated by Mark Duke. Bell petitioned the court for funds for a mental health expert to evaluate Brandon on an ex parte basis to protect the confidentiality of his trial strategy. He hired a forensic psychiatrist to evaluate Brandon, but the 21-page report backfired. The doctor believed Brandon knew his actions were wrong. He acknowledged that he had helped cover up the scene, and he said that he did not feel bullied by Mark Duke. So obviously, Bell left the psychiatrist off the witness list. But the psychiatrist did recommend a neuropsychological evaluation, neurology consultation, and brain imaging, such as an MRI or PET scanning. Bell did have an MRI performed on Brandon, but the findings were negative for any lesions or pathology. He was told there was no facility for a PET scan in Birmingham, and he prepared an affidavit for the psychiatrist to sign requesting funds for an SPECT scan to be done. However, the affidavit was never signed or submitted. Knowing that he couldn't make a real case out of an insanity claim or some other severe mental health issue, Bell decided to focus his case around Samra's IQ, which was considered low at 73, and a combination of what he referred to as gang activity. Bell did manage to secure the testimony of a clinical psychologist and certified forensic examiner. She testified that she had determined through a personality assessment that Brandon Samra was dependent on others and insecure in his interpersonal relationships. This assessment also indicated that under times of heightened stress, Brandon could become confused. During cross-examination, the psychologist admitted that Brandon did not exhibit signs of suffering from any mental disease that would have kept him from being able to determine right from wrong. She did point out that despite appearing polite, Brandon Samra often lacked emotion, which was off-putting, as it implied that he didn't really care about what he had done. Richard Bell had made another strategic error with the psychologist. She testified that when she asked Brandon if he was part of a gang, he admitted he was a part of FOLKS, an acronym for Forever Our Lord King Satan Gang. But she also testified that Brandon told her the murders had nothing to do with the gang. I have discussed many times on this podcast how the satanic panic of the 80s and 90s is now known to have been misunderstood and exaggerated. It is safe to say that any mention of Satanism would have been inflammatory for a jury in this time period. The Equal Justice Initiative later pointed out that these were, quote, allegations so baseless and prejudicial that even the prosecutor recognized they could not be used against Brandon at trial. And the prosecution had it easy in the trial of Brandon Samra. They had his taped confession and the testimony of the accomplices, Michael Ellison and David Collins. They didn't really need the inflammatory Satan-worshipping testimony that could possibly be later thrown out on appeal. After a short deliberation, the jury found Michael Brandon Samra guilty of capital murder. At the penalty phase of the trial, Brandon's parents and his aunt spoke on his behalf. Brandon Samra's aunt told the jurors that she had never known him to be violent and that she had been a part of his life since his birth. Brandon's father testified that after his junior year in high school, he discovered that his son was smoking marijuana. After several incidents, he told Brandon that he could either go to rehab or he could leave home. Brandon chose to leave, dropping out of high school during his senior year. Mr. Samra suspected, based on the way his son was dressed, that he might be hanging around with, quote, gang-type people. But Brandon had denied any involvement in gangs to his father at the time. Brandon's father also testified that although his son did attend regular schools, he took special education classes there and was behind developmentally as a child. Mr. Samra insisted that until the age of 16, Brandon had no behavioral or disciplinary problems and was a loving and obedient child. The Equal Justice Initiative also criticized Richard Bell for not hiring or consulting an expert on intellectual disability or obtaining the recommended brain scans. It was in Brandon's appeal records that Bell did create an affidavit for the scans that was never signed or submitted. But to be fair, the EJI also pointed out that Mr. Bell was a court-appointed attorney, limited to a compensation of $1,000 for out-of-court work, the implication being that he was one man, overworked and underpaid, and Brandon Samra basically got the defense he paid for. But otherwise, from all accounts, it seems that Richard Bell worked diligently for his client. His attempts to tie Brandon to a Satan-worshipping gang were really to show that his developmental impairment led him to be heavily influenced by groups of peers or stronger personalities. But again, it was a terrible misfire. If anything, it added more horror to the slaughter of two innocent little girls. When they reached the penalty phase of the trial, Bell again tried to convince the jury that Brandon Samra was under the influence of Mark Duke in the gang mentality, in order to avoid a death sentence for his client. After a short deliberation, with a 12-0 vote, the jury recommended that the now 20-year-old Brandon Samra be sentenced to death. A year after Samra's trial and conviction, Mark Duke's trial began, now 2 years after the murders. The prosecution team built their case around the testimony of Mark's accomplices and the forensic evidence found in the house. Mike Ellison, David Collins, and the now convicted Brandon Samra all testified against Mark. As the prosecution spoke to the jury, they theorized that Mark Duke had been a member of a wannabe gang and had decided to take his father's life over a minor disagreement over borrowing a truck. The prosecution described how Mark and his three friends had concocted the plot to murder his dad and anyone else in the home, and then planned their alibi of seeing a movie directly afterwards. As described in the trial records, a DNA expert who testified at the trial said blood found in the kitchen of the home, where Mark had gone to retrieve the knife, belonged to his father, Randy Duke. When Mark went to the kitchen to get the knife, he left traces of his father's blood. Randy Duke's blood was also found in the hole in the upstairs bathroom door, indicating that Mark had transferred his father's blood when he punched through that door to unlock it. His father's blood was also found on Mark's left tennis shoe, and Deidre Hunt's blood was found on Mark's right shoe. Randy Duke's blood was also located on Mark's ball cap. The evidence was really staggering against the teenager, and Mark Duke's defense did not really argue that he was innocent of the crime. Instead, they suggested that his father's abuse had pushed the teenager into the act. According to the Anniston Star, the defense team painted Randy Duke as an abusive drunk who bullied his son and drove him to commit the murders. Despite this, and after the jury deliberated for just a little over 30 minutes, on March 3, 1999, the now 18-year-old Mark Anthony Duke was found guilty of capital murder. The jury in the case recommended by a vote of 10-2 that Mark be sentenced to death despite his young age at the time of the crime. The trial court accepted the jury's recommendation and sentenced Mark Duke to death by electrocution. In 1999, Brandon Samra appealed his conviction and sentence based on the change of venue, but was denied. Michael Ellison and David Collins were denied parole in 2004 after serving the first 6 years of their 16-year sentences. They were both released from state prison in 2013 after serving most of their sentences. Mark Duke tried several times over the years to reduce his death sentence to life in prison, but was never successful. But then, in 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court made a ruling that changed his fate. The Supreme Court decided in Roper v. Simmons that the execution of individuals who were under 18 years of age at the time of their capital crimes is prohibited by the 8th and 14th Amendments. This meant that Mark Duke's death sentence was overturned and commuted to life in prison without parole. After many different attempts throughout his time on Alabama's death row, Brandon Samra made one last effort in 2019 to get his death sentence appealed. Samra appealed to the Supreme Court that due to his young age of 19 at the time that he participated in the crime, his death sentence should be changed to a life sentence, like Mark Duke's had. Despite this last-ditch effort in the days leading up to his execution, at the age of 42, Michael Brandon Samra was executed by lethal injection on Thursday, May 16, 2019. The Associated Press reported that Samra's last words were, "I would like to thank Jesus for everything he has done for me. Amen." One of his attorneys, Stephen Sears, told the Associated Press that he had become hopeful that Brandon Samra might receive a stay of execution in the days leading up to the event after they put in a request for clemency to Governor Kay Ivey's office. Ivey had signed a bill earlier in the week essentially outlawing abortion in the state on the basis of the sanctity of life. Following Brandon's execution, Sears reportedly said, quote, "Today, my hopes were dashed. I guess she didn't mean it." In 2017, Governor Ivey did sign a bill into law forbidding judges from overriding jurors who vote for life sentences instead of the death penalty. For years, Alabama was notorious for being the last state in America where judges could, and often did, override the will of juries. The Equal Justice Initiative put out a statement on the day of Brandon's execution, quote, "Brandon Samra was a teenager with significant cognitive impairments, but no significant criminal history, when he was arrested and charged with participating in a high-profile capital murder involving four victims in Shelby County. This statement, as I said earlier, heavily criticized Richard Bell, Brandon's court-appointed attorney. But all of the criticisms mentioned had been brought up in his failed appeals. The Equal Justice Initiative also cites the execution of Brandon Samra as an example when describing lethal injection as cruel and unusual. It took Brandon 27 minutes to die after his injection. Mark Duke is still serving life in prison without the possibility of parole. He is housed at the St. Clair Correctional Facility in Springville, Alabama. Following the murders, the community in Pelham raised money for a gym to be added on to Thorsby Elementary School in honor of Shalisa and Chelsea, and to help with the cost and preparation of their funerals. The absence of the little girls, their mother, and Randy Duke is still felt today, 24 years later. Tara Hunt Simmons, the girl's paternal aunt, while recalling the last time she was able to see Shalisa, Chelsea, and Deidre, told Birmingham Real Time News, quote, "Little did we know there would be no other pageants, no more board games, and after that weekend, my brother would never go back to his home again. He could not stand being there without his little girls." I did not find any quotes directly from the girl's father, Thomas Hunt Jr., but you can only imagine the devastating pain and loss he felt and continues to endure. This case was a listener suggestion, and one I chose not because of the horror, but because I, like many people, often struggle to accept that teenagers can be this evil, despite other cases I have covered. And it is an important story to tell because of the roles that age and the death penalty played in the aftermath. The 2005 Supreme Court decision changed the punishment for teenagers responsible for capital crimes. It was a point brought up in Samra's appeals, especially since Mark Duke was the instigator of the brutal crime. Mark Duke was spared while Brandon Samra was put to death. While the legal age of adulthood begins at just 18, the concept of adulthood beginning at this cutoff has become a highly debated topic. Some studies suggest that our brains are not even fully developed, barring any developmental problems, until the age of 25. Personally, I've always found it strange that you can vote, go to war, and be executed at age 18, but you're not considered legally responsible enough to buy alcohol in most states until the age of 21. I think we as a society need to decide which is it. That's a poor analogy in comparison to murder, but I think you see my point. As a society, we are fine with sending young people off to war, and we certainly encourage them to vote. But when it comes to alcohol, we tend to follow the science. An 18-year-old brain is still developing. People younger than 21 are too immature to make good decisions, to follow the law. However, it is a much more controversial topic when we talk about how we decide who to try as an adult in a criminal court. This debate centers around the cognitive and moral capacities of juveniles, as well as the severity of the crime. As with many aspects of the law, there isn't a one-size-fits-all concept. In America, it varies state to state, depends on the judge or the prosecution, and public perception definitely influences those decisions. I think there was no question that Mark Duke would be tried as an adult for his despicable crime. Of course, I have my own opinions, but I can honestly say that I'm glad I'm not a legislator or a judge. Despite what my critics say, I do have to restrain my own knee-jerk reactions in writing for this podcast. I think for a lot of us, it is unimaginable to believe that someone as young as 16 years old could be capable of this type of crime. But 16-year-old Mark Duke was capable. He killed his own father in cold blood and then cut the throat of a 6-year-old girl before holding down her 7-year-old sister for the same fate. 19-year-old Brandon Samra's culpability is more murky due to his alleged cognitive disabilities and his age. But his part in the murders was equally as brutal as Mark's, shooting Deidre multiple times and cutting Chelsea's throat. To make matters worse, they planned it, and there is no dispute that it was Mark's idea, Mark's plan. Mark even had the foresight to wipe fingerprints off the bullets. That's chilling. And if I was the prosecutor in his trial, I know the picture I would paint. A young mother, shot in the face, still able to scoop up her tiny daughters and run up the stairs. She suffers another shot, loses one of her girls, and locks herself in the bathroom with her youngest, her baby, as she desperately directs her other daughter to run hide in a bedroom. She puts her baby in the shower and tries to hold the door. And then she watches in horror as the boy she thought would be her stepson punches through the door, sticks in his hand, unlocks the door, and seals her fate. She knows she will die. She may be hoping in vain that they won't kill her children. Did Deidre hear Mark Duke tell Shalisa it will only hurt for a minute before he cut her throat? And then little 7-year-old Chelsea, cowering and shaking, hiding under a bed, hearing the big boys coming to get her. Was she even old enough to understand what was happening? And then they dragged her out from under the bed. Then she must have understood, because this baby fought hard. Hard enough that it took both Mark and Brandon to kill her. And now you are the juror. What would you do? Southern Fried True Crime is produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by Hannah Newcomb, with additional research, writing, and editing by me. The audio is edited and mixed by Ches Gray of Gray Multimedia. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. Thank you to listener Jackie Toe for suggesting today's case. If you're not already a member, come join my Facebook group. While we do discuss crime, we also share memes and have a lot of laughs. We worship our patron saint, Dolly Parton, and our motto is, "No shit asses allowed." If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept suggestions on social media private messages. But please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.